Okay, so in today's talk, I'm going to address a perennial and controversial issue that confronts many people in determining some understanding about the way behavior is mapped onto the brain, whether the mapping is onto dedicated cognitive centers, or whether or not there may be an alternative way in which this organization takes place so that behavior is mapped onto more distributed circuits. So a common assertion is that the mapping is one-to-one, such that there are discrete brain regions that mediate particular cognitive functions. For example, the fusiform face area is sensitive to faces, the extrastriate body area to bodies, parahippocampal place area, visual word form area, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to review the evidence for this domain-specific organization, and then I'm going to offer an alternative interpretation in which I will suggest that if one steps back from this, one can see that visual recognition is subserved by more general visual computations that are not domain-specific. And moreover, that domain-specific regions like the FFA, EBA, in and of themselves do not suffice for normal recognition, and that one needs to explore a more dynamic circuit explanation to support these complex visual behaviors. Okay. I will make this argument in the context of the fusiform face area, but the argument is more general. But faces are a really interesting model domain in which to explore this, because many people have argued that they are special, and that they are special in terms of their computational demands, because many different dimensions, the age, the gender, the identity, the emotion of the faces, are all extracted in parallel. It's also the case that this domain has homogeneous perceptual exemplars that are all comprised of the same local components, two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. It's also the case that people have argued that faces need this dedicated, perhaps even evolutionarily specific system because of the social and evolutionary significance of faces. So proponents of this special camp appeal to a number of empirical findings to support their behavioral and neural claims. So one of the signatures of the specialness of faces is that faces presented upright are well perceived, but faces presented inverted are very difficult to perceive, and this is not so to the same extent for other non-face classes. A second signature is that faces seem to rely to a greater extent than other objects on the holistic configuration. And here's some work that was done by Jim Tanaka a number of years ago. He trained people to recognize individual instances like Larry of these sort of Macamug faces. And then he asked them to look at a display like this and to decide which is Larry's nose, or in a jumbled display like this, to say which is Larry's nose. And they found that recognition is far superior in this condition than in any of the other two conditions. So there is greater reliance on the organized whole. Now, interestingly, this is not true for other classes of stimuli, and their control set here were houses. There is also now a plethora of neural evidence to support the special idea. Here is a little bit of ERP data showing that this very specific ERP N170 waveform is larger for faces in red than it is for cars or birds or furniture. Here is a little bit of evidence from single unit recording in monkeys. This is an old study from Bayliss and Rolls. Here are two neurons. This is, on the y-axis, is the neural activity, spikes per second. And essentially, you see that both of these cells show preferentially greater activity for stimuli A through E than F through J. And much support for this claim has come from functional imaging work, which has documented the face-selective activation on the lateral surfaces of the ventral visual cortex, which is preferential for faces over buildings, and this area has come to be called the fusiform face area, compared to a more medial activation in the collateral sulcus, which seems to be greater for buildings or scenes. We also see this face selective activation in some recent imaging studies done with monkey. This is an example from Doris Tsao's work. And you can see face selective activation. Notice that there are multiple face patches here that are activated, and I will return to this issue later on in my talk. But perhaps one of the greatest sources of support for this claim come from the astonishing findings from neuropsychological investigations in which individuals with selective lesions to this fusiform gyrus are profoundly impaired at face recognition. And they rely on the voice or the hairstyle to identify who the individual is. So if you show them faces like this, they may identify on average 17% of such faces. In the last couple of years, we've had the distinct advantage of studying another group of prosopagnosic individuals who appear to be prosopagnosic from birth, hence the term congenital. Unlike the acquired cases, on conventional MRI, there is no evidence of any kind of lesion or alteration to the anatomy. Now, interestingly, they too identify faces by non-face cues. There are some interesting questions here about whether or not these individuals are just from the tail end of the normal distribution. I will tell you that the individuals in my sample all fall more than 4 standard deviations from the mean of their own control group. So this is not an issue right now. The anecdotes of these individuals are much like the acquired prosopagnosics. Here's one such anecdote. When I take my daughter to daycare, if they've changed her clothing during the course of the day, I come to pick her up, I can no longer recognize which is my own daughter. And this disorder knows no boundaries. Here is a snippet from the anecdote, from the autobiography of Jane Goodall, the world's preeminent primatologist, and she says, I suffer from an embarrassing condition called prosopagnosia. It's a problem in face recognition. I used to think I was lazy. I worked really hard to recognize faces. And I was talking to a friend. Turns out the friend also is not so good. And then I discovered that my own sister Judy knew similar embarrassment. And so what do you do under such circumstances? You write to Oliver Sacks. Which is what she did, and not only had he heard of this condition, he also suffered from it more profoundly than she did. I don't know. Well, we don't know that she actually can, and I've had a long kind of discussion with her. Well, I'd be very interested to hear, because it's not clear that she recognizes them by their faces. She recognizes them by body size. There are a whole lot of different cues that you can use. This disorder is really interesting as well because it appears to have a genetic component. Here are some familial pedigrees from some recent work. And based on these pedigrees, the claim has been that the mode of inheritance is autosomal dominant and that the incidence is about 2% of the population at large. We might want to think about this as roughly the right hemisphere homologue of developmental dyslexia, which is about 5 to 7% of the population. And they are profoundly impaired as well, with a wide range of performance, roughly 14 to 63%, but everybody way out of the matched normal range. Okay, I'm going to show you evidence now that examines how special faces are at a psychological level, and then I will explore how special the domain-specific brain region is, the fusiform face area. And I've already shown you a little bit of data on two populations who have an impairment at face processing. The first question is going to be, is it really limited to face processing? So I'll show you some evidence on their non-face processing. And I will tell you up front that they are not normal at non-face processing either. However, they are disproportionately impaired for faces. And so we're left with this conundrum. Why is there this disproportionate impairment? And I will offer some suggestion as to why that might be. I will then go and show you some data on the role of the fusiform face area. I will show you that it is insufficient in and of its own to support normal face perception. And I will show you that one has to appeal to some kind of distributed circuit. Okay, so here's a little bit of data from face discrimination. In this particular task, subjects sit in front of a screen. Two novel faces come up. They're same or different. When they differ, it could be two different genders, male and female. or it could be two different females, i.e. a perceptually more taxing task. And you can see that relative to the controls, both of these groups are significantly slowed, and there is a hint here that there is a disproportionate impairment the level of difficulty increases. They may well be at ceiling here, so it's a little bit difficult to tell. We did a similar kind of experiment using novel objects. These are greebles. Two of them come on a screen. They could differ at a basic level, at a family level. Their main bodies are different in the orientation of the appendages, or they could share these properties but just have different appendages per se. And again, you can see relative to the controls, there is an impairment in both of these groups. There is, however, a disproportionate impairment for faces, and you can see this because I've now mapped them both onto the same y-axis, whereby faces are really taking these individuals much longer to respond than greebles. And so we're left with this question about the disproportionate impairment for faces. I'm going to suggest that faces is the paradigmatic class in which the exemplars are perceptually homogeneous, and for rapid and efficient individuation, the local components are insufficient. What this means is that an observer needs to rely on the higher order statistics, on the holistic information, on the interrelations between the features and the parts. And if this indeed is what is giving rise to this disproportionate impairment in faces, you could question whether or not these two populations have a more general impairment in configural processing. And I'm going to show you data that they do using visual stimuli that are far removed from faces. This particular experiment uses these well-known Navon hierarchical stimuli have been used by cognitive psychologists since the 70s. There are only four possible stimuli. They are shown over here. They are two of the stimuli are consistent, which means the identity at the local and the global level is the same, and the other two are inconsistent. The experiment is simple. You sit there. Your subjects are told, one of these stimuli come up. Subjects are told they need to make an HS identification either of the small little letters or of the global letters. And there's a very stereotypical response pattern that you see in normal subjects. They're all pretty accurate. But I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that red is always faster than blue. This is referred to as the forest before the trees. We always get the identity of the big one before the small one. And in this inconsistent case, where here the response is supposed to be S, given that you've already identified it by this global precedence of the big one, there is some conflict in your response, and so you have this disproportionate increase in reaction time. This is the global advantage and global to local interference, and I've shown that picture as a cheat sheet just up here at the top. So here are the data from the acquired prosopagnosics. I'll show you the CP at the same time, because you can see that in both of these cases, they show an advantage for the local element, for the small little one. And moreover, in this inconsistent case, when they have to identify this as H at the global level, it takes much longer for them, presumably because they're stringing together all the little local S's to get this global configural H. It's also the case that if we derive an index of their local bias, we see that this local bias correlates significantly with their face processing difficulty from that discrimination task that I showed you earlier on. And so the idea here is that at a behavioral level, faces are not as special as one might think, that the computation might well extend beyond faces, but that faces push much harder on this more general visual computation to derive the configural information. So let's now look at the cognitive center itself. And we'll start off by looking at the fusiform face area, since this is the preeminent area that has been thought of as mediating face recognition. Now, we know that this region is necessary for face recognition because if you impair it, these patients cannot recognize faces. So the more telling question is whether or not it is sufficient. I'm going to examine this in the context of the congenital prosopagnosix, and they're a really good sample in which to explore this because they have no lesions and no alterations to the cerebral vasculature. And there is a straightforward prediction from them, and that is if you put them in a scanner and you show them faces, they will show reduced or even no activation in the fusiform face area. Well, it turns out, of course, that that's not true. So we have them in the scanner. They're performing an NBAC task, either on a sequence of faces or buildings, objects or patterns. They're pressing a button for consecutive repeats. And in the scanner, we identify the behavioral impairment in these individuals with much poorer performance in doing the sequential discrimination amongst faces than amongst other visual classes. At the very same time that we see this behavioral impairment, much to our surprise, we're seeing normal fusiform activation. So this is the control subjects. Here we have the congenital prosopagnosix. And this activation in the fusiform gyrus is of the same magnitude, the amplitude of the activation, the size of the activation, and the site of the activation is equivalent. Moreover, this region shows the same adaptation profile as you see in normal individuals. So you probably all know that you get bold reduction or suppression of the bold signal when individuals see the same face over and over again compared to a string of different faces. And here we see the bold reduction in the controls for the different versus identical faces, and we see the same thing in the CP subjects. Note also that this is extracted from the FFA, and we're also seeing nice bold reduction here for buildings and for cars, again reinforcing the claim that this is really not domain specific. So at this juncture, I think we can conclude that the FFA in and of itself is not sufficient for normal face processing, and so we need to go beyond this to understand what is necessary and sufficient to support adequate perception. The claim here that I will put before you is that there is an underlying cortical circuit, and it's through the dynamic distributed activity of the circuit whose joint activation will give rise to face perception. Most of the focus has been on the face processing region, on the FFA, but we also know that the posterior temporal sulcus is face selective. We know that there is an occipital face area that is also face selective. But even beyond this, and here are some data from an imaging study from Alumiti Shai's lab, not only do we see these posterior core regions being face selective, but there is a whole host of additional regions that are also activated differentially for faces, including, of course, the hippocampus, IFG, etc. I'll show you more data as we go along. And so the claim here is that in addition to these posterior core regions, there is also a set of extended regions, including the anterior frontal cortex, anterior temporal cortex, which mediates biographical information, computation of individual identity, as well, of course, as amygdala and limbic areas to support the emotional interpretation of the emotional aspects of the faces. One way to examine the connectivity of these disparate nodes of both the core and the extended system is to exploit the recent findings from work like Fox and Raichel that show that there are these resting state networks in the brain that spontaneously fluctuate at rather sort of slow fluctuation even when an individual is at rest. You might want to think about this as regions that fire together or wire together even when they are not on task necessarily. So we've done the following experiment. This is actually a joint human-monkey study that is being done together with us and in Leslie Angelides' lab at NIH. The humans and the monkeys, although I'll only show you human data here, have this resting state scan. They stare at a blue screen for 2 10-minute periods. We also independently have a face localizer where they see a string of emotional, neutral, famous faces, etc., and buildings, and they're performing this one-back sequential discrimination task. And using this face localizer, by doing the contrast between faces and buildings, we can identify the nodes of this network. So FFA, STS, et cetera, as well as the anterior temporal lobe as part of the extended circuit. What you then do is you overlay these predetermined ROIs on the resting state scan. You extract the time course from a particular region, whatever your seed region is, and then you go and examine correlations in every other voxel of the brain to the seed region's time course. So here, for example, you now can seed the right FFA based on the localizer, and you can see all the other regions of the brain whose time course is correlated with the seed. Okay, so notice here, of course, if you seed the right FFA, you get a whole host of other regions that are activated. Of course, you can put seeds in different places. You can seed the right OFA, other parts of the core region. You can seed the right STS, for example. So this is all done in a single subject. So all the data I'm showing you now is from a single individual, and then you can do group maps, etc. And no matter where you seed, you see activation that is more distributed. Let me contrast for you a single control subject with a single congenital prosopagnosic subject. Here are the circuits from right and left FFA seeds in a control subject, and here we see it in a congenital prosopagnosic subject. So I'd like to draw your attention just to these axial slices, because of course you can see that there is much posterior activation, but these seeds also activate more anterior regions in the temporal lobe, whereas this is not true in the congenital prosopagnosics. And you can do it when you seed in other ways as well, from some of these other seed regions. Again, there is failure to show activation in these more anterior regions. And so the hypothesis that we'll entertain then is that congenital prosopagnosia is an emergent property of a disconnection between nodes of this tightly integrated circuit. Notice also, of course, that I'm not suggesting that this is necessarily just on the feed-forward pass. This is a feed-forward-feedback integrated circuit. And specifically now, I'd like to just focus on one region, that's the anterior temporal lobe, and I focus on it not just because it's nicely activated in some of the recent Rajamir and Tutel work, but because Krieger's court in some of his earlier work showed that individual discrimination, say, between two different faces is best predicted by activation in this anterior temporal lobe. So we're going to explore the interconnectivity between the fusiform and this anterior temporal lobe using diffusion tensor imaging. There are two major tracts that go through the FFA, the inferior longitudinal fasciculus and the inferior frontoccipital fasciculus, ILF and IFOF. The grand the details here are not so important. I just want to give you a sort of high-level survey of this kind of work. I'm sure many of you are familiar with DTI. Essentially, you look at the diffusion of water molecules and examine the orientation or the gradient of diffusion of those water molecules. Okay, so we are simply going to put a seed region in around the fusiform area, and we're going to put another seed region around the anterior temporal lobe, and we are going to algorithmically compute any tract that projects between these two regions, and we're going to do a similar thing for the second tract that goes into, that swings around and ends up in frontal cortex. What I want to show you is that these tracts are well depicted and well uncovered in control subjects. Here's the ILF and the IFOF in two different controls, 42 and 73, whereas there is a significant reduction in the fibers in the congenital prosopagnosic individuals. In fact, in this person, we were barely able to uncover any fibers aside from occasional threads here or there. And we see this across a larger group of controls and congenital prosopagnosics in both of these fiber tracts. And importantly, there's a correlation between the reduction, the compromised structural integrity of the ILF, and the severity of the face recognition impairment. It's not that all tracts are disrupted in these individuals, because we also mapped out some other control tracts. In this case, we mapped out the forceps minor and forceps major, and we see that relative to the controls, there are no macrostructural or microstructural differences in these individuals. It's restricted to the connectivity in this ventral circuit. Now, lest you think that we now have a dedicated face circuit rather than a dedicated cognitive center, I will show you just a small amount of data from an aging study where we're looking at the sort of temporal changes over the lifespan. Of course, the demyelination that accompanies age wreaks havoc on these tracts. As you can see, from 24 to 69 years old, these tracts are harder and harder to uncover. And the age-related decrement in these tracts is well correlated with their behavior, not only on a face discrimination task, but also, albeit to a lesser degree, on a car discrimination task. Okay, so the claim here is that we have a distributed circuit and that the compromise in the integrity of the circuit has adverse consequences on face recognition and on the recognition of other kinds of classes as well. So in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to suggest to you that there is a very particular mechanism that's instantiated in the circuit, that the functionality or the computational contribution of the circuit is key to our understanding of what the emergent property of the circuit is. So in the last few minutes, I'm going to explore this computational role. And I'm going to appeal to some data that fortuitously, perhaps serendipitously, Chris Baker, Carl Olson, and I collected for a slightly different experiment a number of years ago. It turns out that we collected single unit physiology from awake behaving monkeys in the region of one of Doris Tsao's face patches. In fact, the anterior face patch, the region that Krieger's court has argued is the key region for individuation of faces. This is just to show you that this is the anterior face patch, and this is, you can see the track of our electrodes. Now, of course, well, our experiment did not use faces. It used another stimulus class, again showing that this anterior face patch is not really specific to faces. In this particular experiment, two monkeys were trained, and they were trained on stimuli that are made up of this 2x2 orthogonal crossing of upper and lower parts. And the monkeys were trained that if they saw these two stimuli, they were to press the left lever, and the other two stimuli to press the right lever. And as you can probably all discern, it's insufficient to focus on any one of the individual parts. It's only the conjunction that correctly determines the lever response. So with this focus on the combinatorials of these lower level features, we had two monkeys, they saw some trained stimuli, some were not trained, and it was counterbalanced across the two monkeys. We then examined in recording from 331 neurons in one monkey and 171 in the other monkey, the neural responses to both the learned and the unlearned 2x2 stimuli. And I'm going to show you only a snippet here. And I'd like to draw your attention specifically to, this is a single neuron, and this is the spike rate, and I assume you can all read these rasters, for learned and unlearned stimuli. And if we look here just at the learned stimuli, we can see that the response over here is a non-linear output. It cannot, the spike rate cannot be accounted for simply by the additive computation of these two. So here, for example, we have the cactus, and it gives, this cactus and this hexagon give rise to a large response. It can't be the cactus on its own. This is not a big response. It's not the hexagon on its own. You have this super additivity, in which might be thought of as the whole, the conjunction, is greater than the sum of the parts. Okay, I can show you much more data later. And so the idea here is that this underlying circuit, the connectivity between these disparate nodes, instantiates a computation in which the lower order features are gradually morphed into the higher order conjunctions, into the higher order statistics in this posterior to more anterior circuit. This aligns well with some of the computational work that's done by people like Lisa Succeda and Tim Bussey at Oxford, who make similar kinds of claims about this more posterior to anterior circuit. So I would like to argue in conclusion that faces are neither special at a behavioral level, they are also not special in terms of their neural implementation, and that these principles of distributed interactivity between multiple regions in the surface of more general visual computations is general to much of cognition, although I've only shown it in the context of face recognition. There are a number of important questions that come out of this, and that is, what is the moment-to-moment temporal dynamics that happens in the circuit? And of course, this is relevant to this particular question. And I've shown you a little bit of data about the temporal the changes that you see in the circuit over aging. And Susie Scherf, who's here with me as a postdoc, and I have been doing both structural functional studies with young children starting from age 5, both including DTI, to look at the emergence and sort of the initial wiring of the circuit. So I will close off by thanking my collaborators. Some of the initial work was done in the context of Penn with Mike Ta and Isabel Gauthier, and many other people have contributed to the physiology, the resting state work, and the DTI work, and the funding comes from TDLC, NSF, and NIH. Thank you.
There's been a lot of work done recently on what they call mind reading, which is to take these MR images and not just to look at the peaks, but just to ask, you know, how much information is there present in different parts of the data set? And what they're finding, well, Jim Haxby actually originally reported it, which was that there's as much information outside these foci, these peaks, as there are inside of it, if you just recognize whether it's a face or not. And in fact, it's been known from the monkey literature that there are face selective cells outside those areas, not at the same density, but nonetheless, those responses are there. So how does that fit in?
So I'm going to pass the MVPA work for a moment because Mike Ta is talking next, and I think that's the topic of his talk, sort of the topic of his talk. There is many work. It's very interesting. We must do those kinds of analyses. It's absolutely imperative. It's clearly the case that there are cells that are face selective outside of the original regions. And one of the, I think, really dramatic findings that we tend to forget about is in Alan Cowie's early work, where he ablated the regions of cortex that had the sort of density of these face selective neurons, and the monkeys were not prosopagnosic. So therein, in that original literature, I think lay the hint to the fact that the organization could not have been other than something that was more distributed.
Paula? I guess in this context, the question that I have is whether or not children with autism have been scanned and whether or not their face areas are different.
Okay. So we have tons and tons of data. We have, again, DTI data. I mean, your question is absolutely right because it sort of goes to the core of many of these issues. So one of the things that we know about individuals with autism is that they tend to have profuse white matter fibers, not reduction. They have too many white matter fibers, maybe because of a failure of pruning, for example, and, of course, the big head size in the beginning. And so I think that I can show you much more data. We've got children data and adult data. And the claim here is that if you have too little fiber, white matter fibers, you do poorly. If you have too much, you also do poorly. You've got to have just the right amount. And the autistic individuals are a good example of having too many white matter tracts. They too do have significant impairments in face recognition, as many people have already spoken about today. And I'd be really happy to share some of those data with you. Yes, we can actually. So we have we have several published papers on this. I'm happy to point it to you as well. I'll just tell you about one finding from maybe our first paper that I took to be really substantial in understanding the developmental pattern here. And that is that we did the same experiment, just to be clear. We did the same experiment that we did in the congenital prosopagnosics in children age 5 to, I guess it's this, something like this. We did it in young children, age 5 to 8, in 11 to 14-year-olds, in young adults, etc. And really dramatically, we found that whereas the adolescent cortical profile was not distinguishable from the adults, although on closer scrutiny it may well be, children age 5 to 8 did not show anything like the adult FFA. There is no observable FFA in children age 5 to 8. It appears that the time course to get the system up and running, to bootstrap the system, is on a much longer developmental trajectory, sort of consistent with some of the comments that you made earlier this morning about this long time course, both for emotional comprehension and production, but also for face perception.
I have a question. So I have a question about, about theoretically from the data set that you presented, there are two possible ways of thinking about the face networks. One is it's kind of recruited temporarily for the function of face processing. The other one is actually you kind of lay down through the development. So the face network is already there, then you see a face, you activate it. And from the resting data, resting fMRI data seems to suggest it could be laid down already there. So can you comment on that?
Well, so we know one thing. We know that if you're age 5, you don't show face selective activation in these nodes in this network. So it may be laid down, but it's not playing a functional role, even by age 5. So the question is whether or not it is inherently laid down or how it even comes to be wired up. I don't know the answer. We are going to collect resting state data from young children, and my hypothesis is that we will not see an integrated resting state. The functional connectivity between these disparate nodes is not going to be present, and it will really be sort of through the exposure to faces that these regions that fire together come to be wired together, sort of, you know, that you can appeal to HEB really well under these circumstances, potentially. April? Right, and we saw some example of that already this morning, that there is, from the early ERP work, that there is a sort of right hemisphere preference for faces. I think even in those, it's a very controversial and very interesting literature. I think those studies are being attacked both in terms of behavior. So is it really true that the infants are orienting specifically to the mother's face? What properties of it? And there are many people who argue that that's not actually true. And in those cases where you do see an ERP sort of preference for faces, like in Mark Johnson's work, I think the claim that many people offer there is that it's only the sort of initial glimmerings of what will eventually be recruited to be the face network. This has got nothing, it does not look anything like a mature adult face system. It's almost like it's the promise of the face system, at best. And it may even just be a promise of a system that does conjunctive coding.
So I guess I just want to understand this in the context of the activation data from the CP patients. Like, how is it that they would have a normal FFA activation for faces if this is all so developmentally integrated with this distributed interactive system that you talk about?
It's a great question. So it becomes important to understand then what is it that the FFA is doing for the congenital process, given that it's activated. We know that they never mistake a face for anything else. It's not mistaking a face for a hat. They know that it's a face, they'll say, it's two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, but I don't know who it is. Even in looking themselves in the mirror, they lack the sense of individual familiarity. So I think that the answer is that there are some structural descriptions that are derived in these more posterior regions.
So do they recognize emotions and eye gaze direction?
Yes,
and
we have very detailed psychophysical data showing that they have a normal expression recognition using these sort of very fancy morphed paradigms. And so it really seems to be identity specific rather than extending to expression. But these are the interesting questions, like what comes first, sort of the nodes or the circuit, and how do they get wired up? Which is why we need to look at the developmental data in detail and hope that that will give us some leverage on trying to understand the emergence of this architecture. Dan?
What? Marlene, what about the Olivia Pascalis data where you had this narrowing where the young babies were just as good at discriminating monkey faces as human faces? By about, I think it's 7 months, they are no longer any good at the monkey faces? So can you put that into the story? That's all.
I mean, this is a standard finding in development, right, in that you have this perceptual narrowing, both actually in production narrowing as well, where you are no longer able to produce this whole array of sounds. So this is, I think, an interesting universal principle about development. In this case, what I would argue is that they're deriving some structural descriptions in the FFA, and as it becomes more mature, it's sensitive to the statistics of its environment and becomes tuned for human faces. And you need to show them monkey faces all through their development. You have to raise humans in monkey colonies or something. Yeah, right.
So what happens if you try Let's Face It with the CP kids?
Okay, so this is yet another complicated issue. So we know that face recognition has got a long developmental trajectory. So even 6-year-old kids, 8-year-old kids are not really that good at face recognition. Of course, they're not making terrible mistakes, but they're not showing adult-like face recognition. So it becomes really hard to identify CP kids because the whole population is not performing so well. So we've not identified any CP kids, although what we have done is we are tracking the behavior of the children of the CP adults who are potentially at risk for developing CP once face recognition for everybody else is up to a good level.
Well, you wouldn't have to then do CP kids. What about just individual differences amongst a population of children and whether or not that can be changed using something like Let's Face It, and whether or not using Let's Face It then would change their DTI?
Excellent question. We're not doing quite that. We have Susie Schurf as the PI, and I have funding from have new funding that we're working on a study like this in autism to look at the DTI pre and post. But your question is a good one, and that is whether or not you can do a similar kind of intervention with normal individuals and show that over the course of the individual variation in the population, you can get a shift, and moreover, that you can identify the neural substrate of that shift as a beta DTI. And there are interesting and many studies that are beginning to do this kind of work.